Hello and welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. I'm Paul, your host. This podcast is all about Porsche and their cars and the people and the technology and the engineering that goes behind it. You'll find your Porsche stories, which is us, me, talking to you about your Porsche, your journeys and your life experiences with those cars. Tech Talk, which is all about the technical aspects of Porsche. Waffle, which is just me whittering on about basically anything with some friends. And Heritage, which looks at the entire journey of Porsche from the earliest days to the present day. If that sounds interesting to you, then stick around. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to episode 45. How's your week been? What have you been up to? Have you been doing anything interesting with your car? Have you been looking at cars for the first time and thinking about buying your first Porsche? Has this podcast ever helped you on that journey, and whether you've been influenced by this or anything else to buy your first Porsche? I hope so. This week, it's basically, it's a bit of a Heritage episode, to give you an indication to Heritage. If you're new to the podcast, Heritage is more about the sort of back history and the culture around the brand, around the Porsche brand, and what it means to people. So that might be talking to a collector, it might be talking to somebody about their car, particularly if it's a historic car, but mainly around the history and the culture of the brand. And that person this week is Lee Dean. Now, Lee Dean, you probably won't necessarily know his name specifically, but I would probably expect that if you're into your Porsche, then, or your Porsche brand and the, everything that goes with it, you will recognize the name Duck and Whale. Duck and Whale are a magazine, a Porsche culture magazine that have been around for a few years now. Lee is the owner, founder, proprietor, magazine editor, writer, you know, he is him, it is Lee. So I spoke to Lee, when would it have been? Probably about 6 or 8 weeks ago, and asked if he would be interested in being on the podcast. And after a bit of toing and froing, a bit of back and forth, he said yes, he'd like to. So obviously these things take a little bit of time to arrange, but we did manage to get to that. And actually this was only recorded on Monday this week, so fresh out of the box. Some of these things take a little time to actually shoot fully. If I'm going to someone's house, or if they're a company, I'm going to see them as a company. Take Chris at Right Tune, for example, or Frank at Boxing Gas, or you name it. All of these episodes and episodes to come, with Mike Brewer from Wheeler Dealers, for example, that's happening later in the year. So, but Lee and I, because he lives in Australia, there was no need, or it was going to be very difficult for me to pop over to his place and have take a look at his car, which I will do at some point. But that's the episode. That's what's coming up. As you'd expect, though, there's a bit of an intro before we get into that. So, yes. So I think what we'll talk about very, very briefly, because I want to save it for next week. I'm going to be joined by Mick next week, thankfully. And Mick and I are going to talk about the 992.2 911. So the latest version of the Porsche 911. I guess the big thing that came out this week was some spy shots, or not even spy shots, some publicity shots from Porsche Newsroom, talking about the fact that that 992 hybrid is the first time we're going to see a 911 hybrid car. Lapped the Nürburgring 7 seconds quicker than a previous generation car. So Nürburgring times are a funny one. What does that even mean? 7 seconds. It could be the difference between a good and bad driver. It could be the difference between tire compounds, the conditions of the day. There's a million things that contribute to a Nürburgring time. So I say that like I'm an expert, even though I was only there a month ago. I'm not an expert at all, but it stands to reason there's variables at that place day by day. So 7 seconds, whilst it's a noticeable difference over the course of a 13-mile circuit, it's negligible, right? But it does indicate that the car is performing. So, but we're going to get into that properly next week. I don't want to spend too much time talking about that. I could, but I'd like to save something for Mick and I to go back and forth on, because opinions will be strong. And opinions are strong from what I've seen on Instagram. And I saw a couple of posts. Alpha Spot put an Instagram post out The Rengineering Instagram page, by the way, is at Rengineering UK. And it was interesting seeing some people's, you know, varied opinions on it. But like I said, we'll pick that up next week. What else? So I would say I've had some lovely teasers from Dave the Trimmer. You might remember if you listened to last week's episode, I was talking about his Bedford General Waffle update episode last week. And that car, my car, my Outlaw Cayman, has gone off to interior trimming. Well, Dave has sent me some shots and some videos of things like the Art Engineering R logo. If you've been over to YouTube, you'd have seen, or if you've been onto any of the social media sites, you'd have seen the R logo for Rengineering. In fact, if you've even been onto Spotify or Apple Podcasts, yeah, and the icon for this is all the R logo. You should have seen it by now. There's going to be some merch that comes out soon with the R logo as well, by the way. That R logo has been stitched into the seat backs of my car. So, and there's a cool post that I put up yesterday from that showing the stitching happening at that time. Really cool. Lovely to see it coming through. And I talked about a little bit about, and this is always one of those funny things, people squirreling away and pretending that, you know, trying to generate excitement and hype around the fact they can't show you. I can't show you what the car's going to be. Of course you can show me. So rather than do that, I'm putting it out as I see it. I find it interesting, and it saves me having to be kind of crafty and come up with, you know, an event or something to demo. Just see the car, it's fine. So so yeah, that's all good. Excited to see what happens with that. It's still going to be another week or two, I think, before it's finished. But I don't want, you can't rush excellence, right? You can't rush it. What else? So what's really interesting is seeing Porsche now reach out into less into the sort of formal events like Goodwood and things like that, but actually some of the kind of more, I don't want to say this disparagingly because I don't mean like that at all, but the lower level events, the stuff that is more about the people that love the brand across the board, as opposed to, you know, your multi-millionaires that are going to be able to buy, you know, sort of a very custom exclusive manufactured car from a 992 Turbo S or something, right? So that, you know, but actually when you go to things like Flat Six Show, lots of the others, Porsche in the Park is a great example of that as well. There's all these shows out there that are really good, and Boxing Gas Megaphonics. And actually having Porsche starting to reach out now and embed themselves in the rest of the culture in the UK, it'd be really cool to find out if that's happening worldwide as well. So let me know. Do head over and the I'll put a post out. I always put a post out for when the podcast episodes go live. So let me know in that what you think. and what does that actually mean? Does it mean Porsche are particularly keen on exploring more around all types of ownership rather than just the latest and how they can generate revenue? We all know that Porsche are keen, you know, like the head office in Keene, and Grant Larson, the guy that I bumped into at the Stuttgart, really passionate people, love the brand for its fullest extent, but actually it's interesting to see them go to start sponsoring some lower level shows. I think the other thing is the Manti 4RS kit is out now. You can go and speak to your Porsche dealer if you're fortunate enough to have bought a GT4 RS and order a Manti kit. I'm going to pick that up with Mick as well, because he has a 718 GT4 and there is a kit available for the GT4 as well. So I think we'll do a bit of a current Porsche offering discussion and debate next week. For now, though, rather than spend too much time talking, because it's a big old chunky episode, it's a long conversation with Lee Dean from Duck & Whale magazine. So I would advise you go and grab yourself your favourite coffee or a beer or a glass of wine, preferably not if you're driving. And if you're driving, well, enjoy, but I hope you've got a long enough journey, because this one's over an hour long. So, yeah. But let's get on to it. Let's head over and hand over to Lee, Dean, and myself, and we'll learn all about Duck & Whale. I'll catch you back up at the end. So welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to this week's special guest. A man that I have been following, he won't know this, but I've been following since I bought my 981 Cayman, my pure white 981 Cayman back in 2018. His car's been a source of inspiration for me,
but also, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, but that blend of design and cars and the Porsche culture, I think this man epitomizes what that's all about. So morning, Lee Dean, how are you doing?
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thanks
for the intro.
Pleasure. No, it's absolutely a pleasure. Nothing kind of manufactured about that. There's something about the Duck and Whale brand. And for those of you that are listening for this, I've done an intro anyway, so you've heard a little bit about Duck and Whale, but there's something super cool. There's lots of people doing good Porsche stuff out there, good Porsche culture stuff. But every now and again, you stumble on things that feel very different to what other people are doing. And that is Duck and Whale for me. Before we get into Duck and Whale, though, the format of all of these kind of conversations is that we do a bit of a deep dive on the person behind the brand. And I always like to take people on a bit of a trip down memory lane, because it really helps for other people to understand where that source for inspiration came from. So if you're okay with it, I'd like to take you back to your childhood, if you're up for that. And then we'll kind of talk a little bit about where this all came from. So
sure.
Cars or design, what came first?
Cars, I think. Well, art, I was always pretty strong on art at school. But yeah, I was just mad on cars. I don't know where it came from. Like, my father wasn't into it. Just my friends at school, I suppose, that just how I ended up moving away kind of from where I grew up in Sydney, and I moved kind of away up to the Central Coast and of Sydney, which is just about an hour out, but things are further away, and you needed a car to get to places. And if you wanted to be doing something, if you want to go see your mates, you know, at night or whatever, you would have to have a car, or it just wouldn't happen. You can't have your mom and dad dropping you off to places all the time. Yeah. So you needed a car. It was
what was that first car? What was the, and was it bought for you, or did you hunt and peck and save for yourself? And how did it happen?
I came from kind of modest upbringing, so, and I think my dad had said he'd been putting money away, and but he hadn't. And so when it came to the car, I was like, yeah, I want this. And so we found the cheapest possible version of it.
Yeah. And what was that?
I think it was like $1,500.
Okay. Is the car culture in Australia is more GM, Ford, Holden, that stuff, right? So is that kind of where you start? Or is it?
Yeah, it was a Holden Gemini, which is their little four-cylinder. So it must have, I think there must have been a UK version of that, like a Vauxhall, a little boxy sedan, but a small car. The year, maybe 71 or something, or 70.
Oh, okay. Pretty old then. Yeah.
So quite old. And I had a couple of different ones of those. I think I had a wrecked one. I was pulling parts off and I hot it up. The first one was purple as a coupe, and then and I just did some terrible things to that, terrible modifications.
But Dad, give me the greatest hits of the terrible one.
I think my friend had found some paint in his dad's shed that was like metallic green, and he's like, we should really paint like the wing mirrors and different bits and pieces. Oh, it was terrible. Yeah, we're in the party scene at that point, so it just seemed to go.
That got you mobile.
That
got you mobile. That got you two places and gave you the freedom that you've never had before. And there's, you know, how bad that car is. For me anyway, that opened the world up. It was like a really profound kind of experience, that first time where you're not driving in your local area, but you actually go out somewhere and you're kind of on your own. You know, it's an incredible feeling. So
yeah, that's a huge feeling. I remember being in that car and just being in the first drive, and I think the sun was kind of going down, and I got the car and you'd gone through all the details and getting it on the road, and I was just driving it out of my little area there and down this big hill. And I was just like, yes.
Down the hill as well, right? Because then it feels slightly faster than a milk.
Yeah. Just the feeling of freedom, I think, is the thing that gets you. And Yeah, look, it wasn't a fast thing. It was just a car, but you make it your own.
And that's the thing, right? This is interesting because this is a common theme with lots of people that are in this kind of culture, is that even the shit boxes they owned or the first cars they own, you still do something with it, right? Not everybody does that. There's definitely something that happens with car guys and people that are just appreciate four wheels and the steering wheel. Car guys will try and do something with anything, however bad or good it is, they'll try and do something with it.
There's something you can do. Yeah, it's always something. But yeah, like I had a sports seat. I think I had my, because you just find bits and pieces and car parts. I think I found a Recaro seat somewhere, so I had one Recaro seat in the driver's seat because, you know, that's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
I think I put an exhaust on. I think that the second car, I think I got rid of that one because it was full of rust and it was terrible. But I bought another one that we painted. I knew, you know, you start to, develop a circle of friends, and one of them was an apprentice painter, and we end up painting it Porsche Ascot Green. That's what he called it. I've looked up Porsche Ascot Green and I can't find it, so maybe he just made it up, but it was like a bright kind of signal green color.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Maybe there is. Comment below.
Take some comments in and let us know, or head over to Engineering UK and try and see, you know, let us know if there is a Ascot Green Porsche color. I was interrupting there. Go on, please.
Yeah, so that one was kind of my first car that I tried to do properly. It was that was my second car. So nice paint. It had like a Recaro sports seat. I changed the steering wheel to like a small little steering wheel I got from somewhere, a swap meet or something. And I think I put an exhaust on it and I lowered it with like slightly bigger wheels, like from, they must have been 13 to like 14 or something, off a different car that fit. And I just thought it was amazing.
Is that the first time where, because obviously if your friend mentioned about it being a Porsche color, was that the first kind of influence of Porsche on you, or had it come from somewhere else?
Porsche, I came to Porsche quite late, in all honesty. I knew of them. My friend's father had an early classic SC, I think. And my father's kind of work partner had like a, he must have been a 924 or something. It was like a transaxle that he loved and was driving around in. And he was just an electrician, but you know, that was his sports car. And I suppose it wasn't later on, once I got into the magazines, because I suppose the difference is in Duck and Whale, is that I'm a little bit of a hot rodder. I'm a bit of a street machiner, they say over here. I've had very fast cars that didn't handle. And I've been through a few cars, and it was all about power, and we used to do drag racing on the street and all sorts of stuff as a quick kind of skip forward. And then I got into Porsche when I was in the magazines. We got to drive them, and I fast found out that these were something quite different, and they have this amazing balance between power and handling, and balance, like the balance of the actual chassis and just the way everything works together. Whereas I've always had cars which are massively out of balance, huge power, terrible brakes, terrible suspension, and you had to kind of deal with it.
Let's pick up on that very briefly then, because I don't want to skip to Duck and Whale just yet. So you've had that car that you modified, and it was a step forward in the right direction, and it sounded like you took some care and attention over it. But
yeah, but it was slow.
Yeah, it's slow, right? So. I don't want to lose the thread from the design, and kind of, I don't know if you're more into copy or design, but when you were growing up at this point, were you I don't know, left school, going to college or something like that, and you're kind of starting to think about writing or photography or, you know, design in general. Where did it kind of, were they happening at the same time, or did one sort of overtake the other? Where did all that kind of line up?
Yeah, well, I studied design initially, and photography was a part of that. I went down the graphic design route, So at that point, what had happened? I think so. Going to college, I left those cars behind, those early cars. So it was like a four cylinder. God, it must have had 60 horsepower if it was on its best day. And all my other friends had started to pick up cars, so they were either into the V8s, the Holdens, or you know, whatever that was going on, and or they were going down the Mazda rotary route.
Sure.
Because that was like, we were all kind of broke and it was cheap power.
This is what, like late 90s, early 2000s, or what era are we in at this point?
So probably early 2000s, late 90s, that kind of era.
So kind of modify the Japanese JDM modified scene, they kind of reached out into the rest of the world. Fast and Furious has happened, and obviously in proximity to Asia, you guys are much closer than us, so I think the impact bad at that point. So you got a huge dose of, you know, like JDM greatness, right, coming into that, kind of into Australia. So yeah, much easier than us to get hold of those things. We had like a handful of importers, but they would charge the earth for those things, because probably because of the proximity, was so far away that logistics make it expensive. But I get it. I get why you'd get people that are kind of sports car guys that want, you know, the RX-7s and stuff if they landed. And then you've got, I guess, the homebrew guys that are kind of really into their big V8s, and
Well, I think the whole car scene was just going along together, and then it kind of splits into two. So you're either V8 or the actual fast cars for drag racing and things like that, is you would go down the rotary route. And people had started to work out turbo rotaries at that point. And then you could get like 300, 400 horsepower at the tires. Yeah. So that was kind of a way to go. And you talk about the kind of, the RX-7s and things like that. We were always into 70s cars. Like it was always 1970 RX-2 or something, or the RX-3s. The RX-2 is quite an Italian looking thing. But they're very light cars, lots of horsepower, and so we would modify them with in our own ways, but basically to handle a lot of power in a straight line.
And that's when you were at that point, right? You're kind of getting involved in that scene, and Porsche hadn't hit. You're at college and doing your design course, or your, you know, and photography course and graphic design, and that's kind of your outlet for sort of petrol running through your veins at that stage, right? All of that's happening at the same time.
Yeah. So we would just cruise around, and it becomes a bit of a power war, like within the friends and within all the blokes, I suppose. And so I had like large ported rotaries, which was like a peripheral port, which sounded amazing, but kind of topped out at about 200 horsepower. Maybe you can get 240 or something, but you know, mine had, I think I had 180 in a smaller engine version of the rotary. But they're a beautiful sounding thing. If you're into that, for the people that like it, they're beautiful. Some people hate them. But yeah, so we would, once we had the cars sorted, you know, we were kind of, you know, a bit of a crazy group up there that used to go racing. There was a stretch of road that, like a new highway had been built, and the old highway road that stretches up the coast, which is about an hour drive, was now kind of dormant, and especially at night it wasn't well lit. We'd found like a straight which is roughly a quarter mile, and we used to go out there and just all pull over on the side of the road and go racing. And we knew the guy that was in between the police station and And the kind of turn off to go onto the old road where he was at a service station, and he used to ring us if there was anyone coming past.
What a hero. I hope you guys bought him some drinks.
So we were just doing that, and you know, thankfully no one got hurt, and it was all fairly safe. It's quite a big runoff, and I suppose you could get hurt if something broke, but all the cars were well put together, and they all had giant diffs in them and giant things like that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You talked about working in a magazine, and that's where you kind of. So when did that you left college and then started working immediately for a mag, or is it?
Where did I go? I was into cars, and I ended up working for a place that was a PR company. For the Sydney Motor Show when it was happening in Sydney. That doesn't happen anymore. We used to handle that, which was amazing. So you could see all the cars coming in and getting launched. We helped launch the Enzo towards the end of that career, which was super cool,
which couldn't be registered in Australia. There's some rule, so we had to kind of get it in and move it around on trucks, and it was out of control. But that was a beautiful thing. We would launch. They worked for a big client was Toyota, so we would launch all the Toyota cars and do all the graphics and stuff for that alongside the motor show. And that was kind of one of my first gigs that stuck. I got fired from a couple of jobs just because I got hired and they ran out of work, and they were just like, you're last in, first out kind of thing. So I bounced around a bit and then ended up finding my feet in that automotive kind of scene where I, you know, could provide some value, I suppose. I still had the rotor at that point. And then I think I went overseas when it was working in London for a few years. And you know, you don't have a car in London. when you're in the center. That's where I kind of got exposed to Goodwood, and I worked on Autocar for a little bit, and Autosport mainly.
Oh, okay.
And that was pretty cool. I just loved getting back into the scene, and I did advertising for people. I worked in the advertising industry for a while, but I just liked the magazines. I just loved the kind of romance of it, and I love just walking into a bookshop or a news agency they have here in Australia at that point, and just flicking through magazines and feeling the pages. And, you know, there was a lot of anticipation about magazines coming out at that point. And there were some good designers around, inspiring people.
It seemed to go in a bit of a weird direction after a while. I think it's probably mid-2000s though, because the internet had kind of kicked off, forums were everywhere. It wasn't in the, so we weren't into this all the social media world, but information that you'd wait all month for a magazine. We've got Evo is probably the biggest car magazine over, you probably know it anyway, right? So, especially for Evo Car of the Year or something, you'd wait all that time. And like you said, anticipation for that magazine to come out. But when forums started happening and you could Google stuff for the first time, and then that information reached you really quickly, but it diluted, like that hit of dopamine you got from like picking up the magazine and kind of thumbing through the pages for the first time and, you know, seeing some really great photography. Well, people became impatient and didn't want to wait for anything, but then you get a much lower quality presentation. Like no one's thought about what they're writing because it's an instant. And that for me has just got worse and worse and worse over the years. Yeah. So what I really loved about Duck and Whale is the fact that you've almost like retained the bit that was the perfect point, right? Like the ability to produce really high quality media and really think about the wording and the presentation style and the, you know, it's always got this I'm blowing smoke up your ass massively at the moment, but I know that but it's like the sun.
Keep going. Right.
you've got this perfect kind of aesthetic that bleeds all the way through. All I just love it, mate. I really love it. And it's and the internet killed that for me, and it became. And you saw kind of magazines that have been around for 20 or 30 years that just died in a couple of years because of that. So, I don't want to tell your own story for you, but that for me is that's what I has attracted me to the brand, you know, and it all felt, all really does feel very, you know, like it's, there's a purpose around it other than just to produce great content. It's about, you know, allowing people to sort of invest some nostalgia, invest some emotion and feeling into reading and understanding what it's all about. Is that fair to say, that stuff, that kind of little monologue?
Yeah, definitely. And as the internet came in, like I came back to Australia and I started, I picked up some work I tried to freelance like you can in London. It was just amazing. You could freelance everywhere. There's so much work. I came back to Sydney and it just wasn't happening. There's no scene. So I'm like, what do I want to do? I want to go and work for the biggest car mag in Sydney. So I went to either work at Wheels or Street Machine. That were the kind of the big players. And ended up getting a job on Wheels magazine. They had a junior designer position and I just went, okay, let's go. And just working with them, they were some of the best. At that point, it was the best magazine in Sydney, in Australia. It was like their flagship car magazine, like the UK car. I've just got Octane up there. You know, they had world-class journalists. The way we would deal with photographers and the other designers, and you would brief everything and everything was down to the detail. There was so much care. There was like a group of 15 people pouring their lives into this magazine, and getting it correct and right was just everything to them. And you could really, I just picked up on you know, the importance of all these things through all these other people. And, you know, their craft for the magazine and individually. So one guy just, you know, just editing and editing copy and editing it, all those things. And like now with AI, the poor old guys that extend backgrounds and all those things in deep etch cars are gone. But yeah, look, I really picked up on that and, you know, with these guys and was just inspired to do something different. But you could see at that point where I was still working there, you could see the iPads and things coming. Yeah. And we were trying to do an iPad version and no one could really work out how do we get the emotion and experience into this little weird device thing that you just flick with your fingers. And they tried to do different things where the pictures would come to life and you could press on things and it would, you know, and it wasn't working. Like the magazines with like little pages, I know I just get nerdy on magazines for a while, right. But the magazines which weren't like an experience with thick paper and beautiful ink and all that kind of stuff. Mm. They were like, you know, newsstand stuff that was quite, you'd read through the thing and just bin it.
Yeah.
That became the internet. That became your your feed, your news feed on various things. And they couldn't battle against that.
No.
So the only way out that I saw was to keep the experience and up the experience into like nearly book form. And you could smell, you know, when you print a printed page, you would seal it, and I would intentionally take the sealer off and just have direct ink on the page. Yeah. So I intentionally kind of leave these things off. So you can, when you turn the page, you can smell the inks, you can smell, you know, you get the feeling of the paper and it makes that lovely sound. And just to have the tactile feeling of a magazine in your hand, I think is an experience that the iPads just can't.
But then for me, there's the tempt, and I found this with engineering, because I don't have the same skill set that you do, but I want to produce really high quality content or the best I can possibly do and keep learning. But you get sucked into, and it's probably more discreet with print media, but the tempo and the frequency of making that happen, there becomes like a, almost like a, you know, I've got a responsibility to people to get stuff out on a regular basis that is on their timeline, not mine. And then you don't even, I don't know, again, I can't talk for you, but almost feel like you're losing control over the thing you intended on doing it for, right? I didn't intend to do this to make it kind of disposable. I wanted it to be evergreen and somebody able to watch it in 5 or 10 years time and listen to it in 5 or 10 years time and get a rich experience. And sounds like that's kind of the same for you, right? But then you get this weird tension between production frequency and quality, and you've really got to manage that. Is that fair to say as well for you?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, and the readers that know, or the listeners that know Duck and Whale, know that the frequency has been all over the place. Like, I've had massive kind of disruptions in like, it's supposed to be a quarterly magazine, and it's been a few years since we've got four out in a year. You know, COVID made everything hard and you know, more expensive. Everything went up in price. There was like 9 paper price increases in like 6 months or something,
which is ridiculous. And you've got that kind of difficulty that if you've set a pricing structure for your customers, they don't expect to have their prices increased mid-term when you've already agreed a price. So yeah, you either end up having to absorb all that price increase, or you know, yeah, like, what else can you do? Because it's really difficult to go back and ask. And you know, obviously at a period where you're kind of refreshing, then you can make an adjustment, but you can't do that mid-term. So
Well, I used to think that, but every kind of subscription that I you know, that like a streaming service, they'll just send you an email saying your subscription's going up.
You don't question it. That's true. You don't question it.
Everyone's used to that now. At the time, I was like, I can't just put up my prices like halfway through. So yeah, look, it's been difficult. There's been a lot to deal with. Like, I've got 3 young kids, and managing their time and everything they demand of me. And whereas before I could just say I'm doing work and, you know, I'm doing the magazine, this is my thing, I need to get into my, you know, flow state, or it wasn't called that at the time, but you're just working. And now, you know, your time frames are getting shorter and shorter, and all that type of stuff. This year, at the start of the year, I was really keen to get back into it. And on a separate topic, like, my father got ill and passed early this year, and that was that just like knocked me sideways.
I watched the video, and I want to, you know, send my condolences as well, because I watched the video and
the driving.
And I, you know, I'm sure lots of your fans or your kind of the people that follow Duck and Whale would have either experienced that or kind of or potentially seeing that on the horizon. And it's it must be incredibly difficult. So yeah, I think, you know, I can't speak for everybody, but I'm sure it's fair to that we'd all kind of send our condolences for that.
Yeah, thank you. It was it's a strange thing to kind of experience that. And you know, I thought, you know, I know it's kind of going in this direction and all that.
Hey, I hope you're really enjoying this episode. And if you are enjoying this episode, I have a very small request to make. I'm really trying to grow the YouTube channel at the moment, and whilst it's always nice when people naturally gravitate towards it and subscribe and like and share, I'm going to actually ask you, if you're enjoying this episode and you've enjoyed the Rengineering podcast so far, to head over to YouTube and subscribe. And let me know what you think of any of those episodes and if there's anything you'd like to see in the future. But for now, I'll head back to the episode, but just that small request. Thanks, take care.
It was a tender moment, Lee, and I'm conscious that I don't want to, you know, hold you in a space that's difficult emotionally. So why don't we move on just a fraction and kind of start talking about, we glanced over the top of Porsche, but we kind of didn't go into how that came to you. So remind me again where it kicked off. Where went from, like, I know of the brand, I've seen, you know, 930 turbos or earlier or whatever it was, 356s, 912s, whatever. where did it go from being kind of a, oh, this, they're cool, to I've driven one, this is what have I been missing, how do I get my ass one of these, because this is a game changer? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I came working on the magazines. You get to drive everything. Like, it was a cool thing about, a cool perk to that job. You know, we weren't making squillions, but every evening towards, 5 o'clock, there would be a diary on the desk. This was when people used diaries. Mm-hmm. And we would have in there every car that we booked for that week. And we just had a giant garage underneath our offices. And we had all the press cars that came in that we were testing. Mm. And then you just check your name against, whatever car, and there'd just be a bunch of keys on the empty page, and you just grab them and drive. So it was a cool time, and you got to experience like all the different car brands, all the brand new stuff, the hot stuff, the basic stuff. And obviously when Porsche came along, everyone was like, get out of the way. There became a hierarchy.
Mm. Where did you sit in that hierarchy?
Well, I was designing the magazine, so essentially, okay, I didn't necessarily need to be driving them, but we were doing a good job, and the editor was keen to kind of throw us the keys. Mm. as a thing that, we're doing good, we're kicking goals, and here's this for the weekend, or
nice,
whatever. So I drove most of the 996s. I didn't get into the kind of hot stuff until later, until 997s, as I was kind of new to the business, and you don't really want to throw the keys to a 996 turbo to to a junior designer. So I think my first kind of real go where someone had taken, just give me a bit of freedom with a car, was the 997 GT2.
That's a significant car when you don't want to hand the keys to a kind of young guy.
So, yeah, I'd been in cars, like I'd been in the turbo cars with like riders and stuff, and they're trying to scare me with their power, and I'd been in very fast cars, so I was like, yeah, this is great, just kind of feeling the push and the whole thing. Mm. But not being in the driver's seat, it's difficult to understand how it all came together. But you can feel the ride and how sophisticated the ride was, the damping and the push from behind is quite cool, and how the cars squat down and grab traction, even though the four drive. But yeah, the 997 GT2 was kind of the first thing, and it was like a baptism of fire. And I've been in there. So we had the creative director in the passenger seat, and I was in the driver's seat, and we were going up the top of Bondi Beach. There's like this giant flat kind of plateau, kind of cliff face, and it's on the top. And it just started raining a little bit, and it was kind of damp, I suppose, on a little bit of water on the road, but not too much. And I came through there. We had a little test loop that we would drive from work. Mm. And I just nailed it down in second gear. It was like manual, obviously. I'd shifted into third and just nailed it. And I think they're 570 horsepower, rear drive, massive fat rear tires, and it just lit the back tires and just started to drift just a little bit, just a little angle. And the creative director freaked, like he was and he's grabbing the doors and like, all he said was, dude, like, what are you doing? And I was just quite comfortable. I'd just grown up doing that, and so it just kind of just lent a little bit and just skated up the road. And I just thought, oh, wow, this is something quite special. And we got it onto the track and we started to develop those types of things. But you could just tell that this is a very different machine. Mm. And then I started to peel the onion back and started going backwards through the generations and started kind of my Porsche journey from there. But that was kind of the first crazy moment, which I just went, oh my God.
And this similar kind of thing has happened a few times where people have had a moment or an experience, or whether it's a passenger seat drive or they've been in the driving seat, but it's like a catalyst, you know, someone's just lit the touch paper and then it's a bit like, well, that's changed everything for me now. What do I do now? How do I go from being kind of privileged enough that I can drive one of these to how can I own one of these? So let's talk about owning one then. So where did that happen? Because yeah, how did it go? You mentioned about going back in generations, but yeah.
Okay. Well, so I ended up with a 73 911. I think I just loved the 70s cars. When I was younger, I was always just in 70s cars. I was in 70s Mazdas and 70s, you know, Holdens, Vauxhalls, or what do we call them? I was doing work. What was I doing? How did I get that one? So I kicked off the magazine just loving Porsche without owning one.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So, I wanted to do some kind of magazine. I wanted to do some kind of business on my own, and have a bit more control. And, you know, the wife's like, I was thinking about doing some other thing. And she's like, are you sure you want to do this? Because we're going to go down this road. Like, you really have to love what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I just said, well, I love Porsche, you know, just part in passing. And she's just like, well, do that.
Nice.
And I'm like, well, you know, really? I further grew out of that. And then I, you know, a lot of people say they're going to do things and it doesn't kind of work out, or they've got aspirations of doing things. So we were in a position that we were lucky that I could do it and take a chance. And it was kind of born out of a silly conversation with my wife saying, yeah, well, why don't you do something you love rather than just something that you think is going to make money? And so we kicked off from there. And Duck and Whale, I think I did Duck and Whale first issue in like 11 days.
You must have harvested content kind of, or, you know, stories or whatever it was that you were kind of going to, you know, you must have had a bank of that stuff to be able to go with an issue quite quickly. Because, you know, then if you can curate something and not just put something out without really thinking about it, that, you know, all of that's got to come together. So 11 days.
Yeah, I knew a lot of photographers, and I just said, look, man, I'm going to do this magazine. Do you want to be in the first issue? I don't know if it's going to go well or not. You want to just do something? And he's like, yeah, okay. You know, people were like that. So, and I'd ring people and say, wait, I'm doing a Porsche magazine. I'm going to get a professional photographer come out. At that point, I didn't shoot. I wasn't shooting kind of full time. And I was just leaning on a couple of people that I knew. When you're at that, you're like, am I really doing this? Am I going to do it?
Yeah.
And I would call people and with a car that I knew or something. I say, look, I was part of the Porsche club as a associate member or something. And then, you know, found a few people with cars that I wanted to feature. And I said, I'm going to do a magazine, you know, and just saying that kind of got me into, kind of forced me into doing it. And we did the shoot, and I pulled it all together, and we did some interviews and different stuff like that. I think I bought a couple of articles that you can do that at the time.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Like syndicated stuff from different other magazines around the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And it all came together and was launched. And I had no idea. I had no idea I would even make four, let alone like where we are. It's a beautiful thing to be able to do your art and pour a bit of magazine craft into something where the buck stops with you, and you can just do mad art and there's no one there going, yeah, that doesn't really work, man.
Or it's not commercial enough, or, you know, or it's, we don't have the budget for that, or, you know, all the things you're going to get thrown that kind of just they make everything 10% less than what you want it to be. Actually, when you're in the driving seat, you can be like, we just wait another 2 weeks. If that's what it takes, that's fine.
Yeah. And you know, there's a formula to mainstream magazines that, you know, each one will have a different types of a formula, but, you know, you would always have to, you want to show the car, you want to show the front, you want to show the sides, you want to show all the angles. They've been briefed like that. The shoot's been briefed like that. We want a panning shot, you know, and usually they launch with an open over the front three quarter, and then they, you know, go to the interior and, you know, all that stuff. Whereas I was just starting with like this really sexy shot of, you know, like a gear shifter or something and some crazy type. And, you know, when I first kind of kicked off, issue one's a bit mental, but no one can get it because it's, you know, it's sold out, but. Yeah, and we were in newsagents and I partnered with some guy that was shipping them overseas, and he said he was a distributor overseas, but it was all part of this network of news agencies and shops.
Yeah,
so you had no connection to the actual end user.
Right,
you only had connection to these people who would just forward it out to their network of random shops. And then they would sell a percentage, and then the rest would come back.
It's pretty rough, right?
It's so rough. So it was like if you were selling 60% of what you printed, then that was awesome. And I
don't know about you, if I was in that situation though, the connection to the people and the feedback and the endorsement and the reverse dopamine, almost, they get the dopamine of opening the magazine and indulging in this kind of almost semi-fantasy world of the culture that they love, but then you get that when you get some feedback and they're kind of sharing how it's, you know, they were considering doing it and, you know, buying a car, and that kind of article that you produce has been the thing that's kind of catalyst for them going out and actually buying a car for the first time, right? So, but if it's through distributors and you've got no connection there, I personally would find that really difficult. I love hearing from people, you know, I love speaking. So.
Yeah, that was very weird. So, I knew I was creating a decent product that people wanted and had a bit of longevity to it. But at that point, people weren't really shopping online. And when we kind of kicked off in 2015, it wasn't, I don't know if they would, you know, you had your early adopters, but it wasn't kind of widespread.
Yeah.
But once it kind of picked up, and what issue did we go? We pulled out of news agencies and just went totally online. I can't remember, but that was a bold step. It was fairly early on.
You can't see this.
Like five or six or something.
Just to let everybody listening know that Lee's got a massive stack of duck whammy. That he was just referencing, I think, to try and figure out where that was, but
yeah, sorry, it's not good radio, is it?
It's fine, don't worry, it's cool. It's just nice to narrate a little bit as well and give the audience a bit of an insight into, because you obviously can't see this, but we'll circle around at the very end to Duck and Well's future, but let's talk about your build, your hot rod, your outlaw.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So talk to me about what that car is, what it started out as, the condition, and kind of the journey you've had with that car. Because I've got it, like I said, right at the start of the sort of intro to this. In 2018, I bought a 2015 981 Cayman in pure white. And I looked at your car and I was like, dude, if I can kind of have a modern take on something like that. That's it for me. It's distilled Porsche, you know, like you can get PTS this and that, and it's great, and you just more trinkets and more add-ons, but it felt like you kind of really, it's almost like an artisan gin distillery, and you've kind of thrown in the Porsche to the top, and out at the bottom you've got this kind of what I think is one of the best versions of that car. It is, so I love it, mate, clearly, because I've just kind of waxed lyrical on your behalf. But yeah, talk me through that experience and buying the car and everything, where we got to today.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Well, thank you first. Look, I was looking for a car, and I was looking to buy a house. I was looking to buy a car, and both of them were running from me. Like the market was going mad on both. And I think I got outbid on some old ST kind of race car that, you know, at the time they weren't really worth a lot of money. No one wanted race cars. And there was a sexy flat red, ugly red, people would call it. It's probably called some not nice Porsche color, but I can't remember. And it was a cool ST kind of build that a guy was racing, and he sadly passed away, and it had kind of gone into up for auction through another collector here in Sydney. And I put a bid out and said, can I pick this up? And I got outbid by someone in Bermuda. And you know, so I'm just like, oh my gosh, I missed that one. And I found another blue one, and I was flying like 3 hours up the coast to try and get to it. And I worked out, I can do a shoot up there. I know a guy up there with an old 356, and I'm going to get that. I'll shoot that, and then I'll go and look at this car. So the guy who owned the car had actually said to some other interested parties, the Duck and Whale guy's coming up. He's going to look at the car. You'd better act fast, you know? So someone had bought it and shipped up 10 grand to this guy.
Right. Okay.
And then by the time I rang up just to confirm, hey, I'm coming tomorrow morning after the shoot, he was like, oh, sorry, man, it's sold. And so I was just kidding. I was heartbroken at that one.
Yeah.
And I was just, you know, I was down in the dumps, and a friend of mine who runs a local workshop, you know, people sell cars to them because, and they just kind of pick them up because they don't want to go down the usual car sales thing. There'll be something wrong with the car, or it doesn't fit into the box of this will sell well, matching numbers of like race history or something. Mm. So yeah, they had this left-hand drive 911 T, bit of a race paint job on it, and no insulation, kind of, you know, the whole thing. And they, at that point, they were, if you brought in your car and you're a good client, you could take this car. They had three spare cars that they had. Mm. You could take that car and like drive it home, and then come back and pick up your car once it had been serviced or whatever. So they said, oh, you should, you know, we've got this one if you want to drive it. I'm just like 911 T, like it's, you know, it's old, and it was super harsh.
Mm.
And I hadn't driven it. And I was kind of looking for a big fat wide bodied something.
Yeah.
And eventually he talked me into it. A friend of mine who's a good Porsche collector guy that's right into it. He was kind of born in a Porsche, brought home in a Porsche, and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
He just said, look, Porsches are a delicate, beautiful thing. They're not all massive fat guards, and you know, you need to, you know, go and appreciate that thing, and go and appreciate the narrow body and whatever it is. So anyway, he said, go and take it for the weekend. Just hear the keys, go, you know, you're miserable. I just went driving in it, and I just loved it, because he put it forward to me, because he's like, what do you want in a 911?
Good question.
You know, because there's so many things. Yeah. And I'd driven a bog standard. They say bog standard, it's an old term. A factory standard is a bit better, isn't it? For factory standard.
Standard's like, it's still a UK term. We use this. You're listening in. We've got weirdly loads of listeners in Indonesia. Bog standard just means it's completely from the factory, nothing's changed, right? So
yeah. It was a red 964 C2 coupe.
Yeah.
And I drove it around, and I think I got dragged off the line by a girl in a barina, like a you know, of like a Vauxhall Corsa, they call them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just like, I'm just trying to drive this thing, and it was just like, you know, it's lovely and supple, but I wanted a hard kind of GT3 style experience in an older car. And you know, I was kind of explaining this to him, and he said, just, you know, this car in front of you is the answer, and you know all you have to do is drive it. So I took it away, and it was like, you know, it's carpet, just it is literally spray glued onto the floor. Race seats, it's got a cage in it, harnesses. It's a 3 liter. It's a standard 3 liter, mainly because the guy that put it in the car was trying to emulate the RS in its weight and its power. Because it's roughly the same as a 2.7 RS.
Yeah.
Doesn't rev. It doesn't have that beautiful rev and the pops and the, you know, all the lovely sounds that the RS engine does, but it's roughly the same power and torque, and it just delivered in a different way.
So you bought that, did you? That was it. So you've been out for a drive in it, and you kind of I guess had kind of started to fall in love, or at least appreciate what that car was and what it potentially could be. Did you sign yourself up straight away, or was there a bit of a it's kind of there but it's not quite, in, you know, where did it go?
Once I got used to the left-hand drive thing, and it takes about half an hour, I suppose, but it felt quite weird. But I was driving around at night, and it's so loud. With like driving a car at night is quite a strange experience, because all the sounds bounce off everything, and there was so many little. It's quite low. I think it's even on the bump stops. It's like creaking and all sorts of stuff. And once I got it out during the day, and the next day I took it out to this. There's this road to the north, which goes out on a headland that looks out over the place where they filmed Summer Bay for what's that show called?
Home and Away.
And it's like a national park. It's one road that goes out and then splits into two and loops around and comes back the other way. So once you kind of go in and come out, you can understand if there's anyone in there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't, so we could kind of let things go, and the car was just singing. It was once it comes about 4,000 RPM, it's the note changes, and it's really nice. Just the suspension, everything was kind of really, really tight and cool. I do like that. You know, someone asked me the other day, what kind of 911 do you have now? And I said, I don't know, that you can do so many things. He said, okay, you can choose two, a Turbo S or a GT3.
No question.
So, you know, I guess I'm in the GT3 camp, because I like that kind of style.
Yeah.
And then I didn't give the thing back, and I bought it quite cheaply at the time compared to now, and I just slowly started. It was white. It had the Carrera down the side with the red wheels.
Okay.
It had polished pedals cut out of the red.
Okay.
Which looked a bit odd.
Hmm.
And it had my 73 RS number plates on it.
Okay. There we go. So it was influenced by something. So how did you take that car, and then, because that's not what it looks like now. It's on, you know, black wheels. It's still really low. Go and have a look at the Lee's, you know, Lee's, your accounts, you know, you've got loads of pictures of it anyway, right? So, and the YouTube channel's also got tons of video on it. So, did you go into it with a vision in mind from all your experience from the mag and kind of speaking to people and investing yourself in the culture, or were you kind of like, it was just going to organically come to you as you were kind of doing it? Like, how did you go? Which way did you go?
Yeah, well, I started doing a couple of different liveries for the car, and I designed it as to how I kind of want it on the computer. And so I went through a large process of distilling down all these different mad things and other liveries that I liked. And I just kept coming back to the simple stuff of simple Porsche down the side, gold wheels. I think I I sprayed the wheels gold. I had them painted, in a gold that which was similar to a gold, a Porsche gold that had come out at the time, that they were using on their accents and stuff.
Yeah,
I think potentially on the GT2 RS there was a gold. I think there's a painter that I know that down here, Ron Goodman. And I think there was someone had been the GT2 RS and he's like, I got some extra gold paint, you know, if you want to do those wheels.
Dude, I remember when I bought some GTS or Boxster Spider wheels for my car, and I ended up painting them satin aurum. But I remember looking at your car and going, I wish I knew. I don't know why I didn't ask, to be fair, but I wish I knew what gold that was, because I would just steal that color. It's such a great color. It's almost like it's like gold, but then you've driven the shit out of it on track and got brake dust all over it. That's the color, right? Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So now I've got three sets of gold wheels for the car. So I had the Fuchs, and then I ended up getting the 1552 003s, which are the Magnus Walker version 3 that they made, very limited, and they're in a 15. The Fuchs are a 16. And then I think Jonathan at Group 4 Wheels,
over
in the UK there, so he sent me over a pair of a set of the compacts, mm-hmm. and they're in a 16. They kind of took over from the Fuchs, and I put my track tires, the Yokohama AO50s on that. So now we've got three sets of gold wheels. Nice. Which are kind of interchangeable.
You know, like, oh, I fancy a change up, and you can just roll it out and jack it up and you're off you go.
Yeah. So, you know, the new cars have the PASM switch.
Yeah.
Whereas because the suspension's so locked down, I wanted I've got my track tires, which start off supple, but as the kind of heat cycles go through them, they can get quite hard. As they get balder, they can get, you know, you can still use the grip as long as it doesn't rain. But they can get hard. And then, so I got a giant, like a 70 profile. What are they? I can't remember. Written somewhere. Giant 70 profile tires with just giant beefy things, and the sidewall flex is the comfort switch.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. What engine is that car now? Did you mess with it, or is it still the same with the same performance?
I haven't messed with it because it's just such a sweet spot. I suppose it could have more power.
I'm on a real kind of rant mode about this at the moment. If you take your car, or you know, an RS, or kind of any of the early cars, they felt powerful, right? 300 brake horsepower, 230, 240, 250 brake horsepower felt really, really lit. Somehow, in between the 70s and the 2020s, we've gone from that, which people were perfectly happy with and felt like, you know, for the contact patch of the tire, the grip level you have with the compound of the tire, to where we are now. You've now got this like, oh, well, everything needs 700 brake horsepower or 800 brake horsepower. It's ludicrous. Yeah. No one needs 700 brake horsepower. It's completely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Anyway, I could do a whole episode and rant. If I'd probably have done an episode ranting about that, so I won't do that now. But
yeah. Well, the air cooled, you know, you can go up to about 350, I suppose. But look, it's got 200 horsepower, and the sweet spot, they say that the 73 RS was, you know, was one of the best Porsches ever made in that kind of power and weight and how it all comes together. So, you know, yes, I could change it. And if it blows up, I probably will, but at the moment it's a standard 3-liter, SC engine in the car.
So we're starting to sort of head towards the end of the session. So let's talk a little bit more about the future of both the magazine and the car. So let's do, we're on the car already. So if the end we talk about if the engine blows up, you might revise it, but otherwise, is it are you in that kind of lovely utopia where you're like, well, I don't need to do anything with this, right? If I have a mood change or I'm going on track, I can sit this set of wheels on or this set of wheels on, but otherwise that car is done. Or have you got your eye on kind of things in the future as well?
I was going to do up the interior. I had a vision to do something with the car, to go on longer drives and make it more comfortable. And that's kind of evaporated.
You'll have a family car. You don't need that to be a family car.
I know. People say to me, "Oh, I'm selling my Porsche because I've got a family." I'm like, I have three boys and a 911 with two race seats in it and a roll cage. Like, you don't like that because you've got a family, you need the Porsche.
You do. You do. Right. Everybody listen to this. It's come from leading owner, founder, editor of Duck and Whale magazine. If you have a family or you're starting a family, you need a Porsche, right? So if you don't believe us, you replay this to your wife or your partner, and hopefully you'll get yourself out of
You
jail.
need to get away occasionally and get your head showered and just go for a drive, and then you come back, and then your batteries will be recharged, and you can be a great father or mother.
Okay, so the interior is going to actually stay the same. Anything else? It's pretty good. That car's pretty good.
It's got old. At the time, everyone was putting 964 RS door cards on everything because that was the only there was like a limited parts. Whereas now you can get lots of different stuff. I was going to redo the interior. I might just put new carpet in. People talk to me about sound deadening and stuff, and it freaks me out. I'm like, I don't want to add weight to the car, and I don't want to take away the noise. All the great Porsches that are coming out now, you probably notice I say Porsche and Porsche.
And we all do. We all do. It's there's no judgment.
So I got attacked by some dude on YouTube about it, but anyway. Like, I don't want to do that. I'm happy with where it is at the moment. And one thing it reminds me of, oh, sorry, I'll finish that point. So I'd probably put more period race car door cards and things in it. It's got a new black dash. It's got a white perforated new hood lining. The back parcel shelf is just like is sound deadener like fire mat and nothing else on it. So I probably need to put some carpet or sort of do some kind of trimming. Because people are like, "You're gonna finish the interior?" I'm like, "Oh,
Oh, maybe so. Yeah. Two, two.
maybe race car." I look forward, man. I'm looking backwards.
Exactly.
But I don't know if you guys got it over there, and it's a car guy thing, and this is a nerdy fact that there was a Shell Formula One ad, and I don't know if you remember if you got it, but it started out really really early, and it went through all the race cars, and they were driving kind of through the cities of the time, and it started out with the old super old mad old red. Who's the guy that who's the old race car Ferrari race car driver? It's in my mind. I can't remember. Anyway, and it would it's a funny little ad, but that sticks with me. And every time I drive my car, I'm like, it sounds like that. It sounds like that they would shoot people sitting in a cafe, and then the car would like hammer past them. And then it would lock onto the car. As a movie maker, I was always interested on how the footage changed, the aspect ratio on different stuff. And it went from it kind of came through the genres into the V10 and all that stuff. But coming through kind of the 70s race cars, it always kind of reminded me of my car and at full noise when I'm like right on the limiter of the car. It's that old classic, just raspy, mad flat sticks roar.
An overrun, right? When you
Don't
check
want to lose.
there's that like there's a that little bit of overrun, and you just dip the clutch and you almost have to double the clutch because it's got no synchro or something, and you just get that and then you're into the next gear and all of that from that era. I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. There's it's not about for me anyway. extracting every little performance to win a race. Like, that is what you do in motorsport. But there was a definite sweet spot in the 70s where, you know, it just all felt like it was a little bit safer and less people were dying, but at the same time, there was still danger, you know, like it. And I think that actually is the case with the with road cars at the time as well. There's always that sort of tension again, that like that sense of danger, that sense of raw, you know, feeling you get in the car. So yeah.
I could make it nice, but yeah, screw that.
So what
I
about World Magazine? What's that? What's the last sort of, what's the next stage for that? Is it just a case of you own the journey and you put the great content when you can, and you bring people along with you? Have you got any other big grand plans, or is that pretty much just, you know, just do your thing in the time you have and when you get a chance?
Like I fully intend to get it back on track. I'm in a good place now, and I just want to do some art and do some work. I really just need to get into a groove with some work, and that's really what is probably the best thing at the moment. And I'm looking forward to making more videos and doing more issues, doing more great photography, I think I've missed it. I've missed putting them out, and I've missed being on that schedule, and I've been through some crazy stuff this year, and I just want to dive back into what I love to do.
Well, look, I've loved the conversation, Lee. I hope you've been, when you've been listening to this, I hope you've enjoyed it as well. I'm not going to ask Lee to comment on whether he's enjoyed it or not, because if he says no, then that's going to be really embarrassing. Hopefully you've enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's been great.
Oh, thanks, man. I am planning coming out to Australia, so yeah, it'd be good to come and spend some time with you and check the car out and go for a bit of a drive then. But for now,
Sounds
that's
great.
leading duck and whale. Thank you for your time, and yeah, much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, look me up when you're over here, man. We'll go for a drive.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Again, you can tell I really enjoyed that. I sort of said right at the end, didn't I, really? But what it tells me a little bit as well is, if you're listening to this and you're not in the UK, but you're still keen to come on the podcast, you are welcome to do that. It is possible to get a rich conversation out of Zoom or Teams. You know, you can do that absolutely fine. It just, you've just got to sit and talk openly and let me know what your interests are. And Ross, whether it's Ross Moultrie or whether it's Michael Lindsay, or if it's Jeff from Home Built by Jeff, or obviously Lee from Duck and Whale. There's a few of these now that have gone backwards and forwards, and I've loved every one of them. So weirdly, actually, the conversation seems to flow more naturally in some cases when it's over Zoom or Teams. You just seems to be able to be, because you're facing at each other and you're focused on the conversation. It makes it rich. So I hope you enjoyed it anyway. Please do let me know what you found interesting. One thing I will say is, Lee mentioned about some racing circuit and some racing from the 70s and 60s and 70s, and he was struggling to find the name of the racing driver, and he messaged me afterwards and said, Fangio, it was Fangio. So there you go, Fangio. I don't have anything else for you now, but I do hope you've had a lovely week. I think over an hour and 20 minutes or whatever this is at right now is long enough for an episode. But yeah, please do head out, and like Lee said, you know, you need a Porsche in your life, especially if you've got a family. And I will see you next week, and it'll be Mick and myself going back through everything to do with current Porsche offering for next week. Take care for now, though. Bye-bye.